Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States v. Mack. Is the defense ready to proceed? Please do so.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Brian Meiser, and I represent the appellant, Aaron Malcolm Mack. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
That's granted.
51 years ago this month, this court invalidated private first-class Bay Hands convictions for disobedience of orders that were given in violation of Article 13 UCMJ. The order in this case is identical to the second order at issue in Bay Hand, and it imposed conditions more rigorous than necessary to ensure appellant's presence at trial. Article 13 has not changed since Bay Hand was decided, and the orders such as the one at issue in this case are no more lawful today than they were in 1956. But the government argues that military commanders may in fact issue orders imposing illegal pretrial punishment upon service members, and that the only recourse of service members is to obey the orders and then to seek confinement credit at court-martial, if that happens, pursuant to Allen and Mason. This argument ignores not only Bay Hand itself, but 57 years of this court's jurisprudence regarding challenges to the lawfulness of orders. In the past 6 years alone, this court in New, in Washington, in Deischer, and last term in Casala has reaffirmed the long-standing principle that service members may challenge the lawfulness of orders if the order violates an important statutory or constitutional right. Protection from illegal pretrial punishment is such a right. And the military judge, having found that this order violated Article 13 and that the restriction was tantamount to confinement, should have determined the order to be unlawful. The military judge cited Bay Hand twice on pages 108 and 109, New on page 558, but he failed to correctly apply these cases in resolving this.
You're arguing that he should have found the order unlawful for all purposes, period?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the holding of Bay Hand. The military judge should have, after determining that this order violated Article 13, should have invalidated the order, the breaking restriction order, whether it was charged under Article 134, breaking restriction, 86, failure to go, or 90, 91, 92, 90 was the issue in Bay Hand.
So the theory of the defense is that if an individual is confined and believes that the confinement is improper, they resort to self-help?
No, Your Honor. If an order plainly violates Article 13, they may, in fact, resort to self-help. They do so at their peril.
Do they have to exhaust remedies first?
Your Honor, there is no case law on this issue that would suggest that they have to resolve or exhaust administrative remedies.
And which case stands for the proposition that a person confined under circumstances that would subsequently entitle them to credit has the authority to resort to self-help, specifically on that point?
No case stands for that proposition, Your Honor.
And why should we authorize individuals to resort to self-help at that point as opposed to using the processes for correcting confinement problems?
Well, Your Honor, because Bay Hand cases that follow it, Gentle, for example, may not endorse self-help, but they do not then endorse the government imposing punitive restrictions in the form of court-martial convictions for the disobedience of those orders.
Why isn't the credit process sufficient to remedy any deficiency that would take place here?
Because we're dealing with an important statutory right here, Your Honor, and that is Congress's desire that these orders never be given, that illegal pretrial punishment not happen. There's an extensive discussion, and it's cited in Bay Hand, in the legislative history of the code to prevent precisely these types of orders, the rock breaking at issue in Bay Hand, the punitive musters that were at issue in this case. And when you have a violation of the statute, such as occurs in this case, it should be a defense at court-martial to a disobedience offense such as this.
What was the purpose of the commander's order?
To purportedly, Your Honor, was to ensure appellant's presence at trial.
That's the sole purpose?
No, Your Honor.
Was he concerned about drug dealing, for example?
He was, in fact, concerned about narcotics offenses.
So is it your view that with concern that this person was going to deal drugs from his car and do other things like that, his sole option was he was just out of luck, that Article 13 prevented him from taking these steps to prevent drug dealing?
He was not out of luck, Your Honor. The military commander in this case could have imposed terms that were not more rigorous than necessary to ensure appellant's presence at trial.
So if he's dealing, so what term was more rigorous than necessary that you object to, and how does it relate to preventing drug dealing?
Specifically, the terms that appellant was is convicted of, the restriction terms, and also riding in an automobile.
So if he's trying to prevent the guy from dealing drugs, he's not allowed to have him report for musters?
He can't have him report to musters, Your Honor. The manual makes that clear. This court's case law makes that clear. But that's not exactly what happened in this case. Appellant was required to muster four times a day during normal working hours, eight times a day during weekends. Importantly, he was required to do so at punitive restricted man's musters at Barracks 215, this dilapidated barracks, which the command sergeant major refers to on page 88 as a flop house. Those are conditions that are more rigorous than necessary.
So your argument is he could have had him report for restriction, but not at Barracks 215 or that particular barracks?
We could debate
white seating.
Yes, Your Honor. We could debate whether four times a day is excessive, particularly when he's reporting to work. We don't have to, though, because that's not what happened in this case. It was four times a day at punitive restricted man's musters, in addition to Barracks 215, this building that was later condemned. So we have conditions imposed upon appellant that far exceed those necessary to ensure that appellant was going to be present for trial, or, as your question suggests, the other consideration that a commander may consider, which is preventing future misconduct. If you also look to the terms of the car, why could appellant not have at least ridden in a car to the chow hall? Why could he not take a ride to work in the morning? There was no suggestion that any time he got around a car, he was going to begin dealing drugs. There certainly were more narrowly tailored provisions if the commander wanted to.
So he might not make a cell phone call from the car, for example?
He certainly could, Your Honor, but the conditions of restriction are to be no more rigorous than necessary to ensure the appellant's presence at trial, even if imposed for the lawful purpose of preventing serious misconduct. It is important also for this determination that the commander placed appellant in pretrial confinement, and a neutral and detached magistrate ordered appellant's release from confinement. And the commander's response to that then was to impose conditions that were then tantamount to confinement, thus circumventing again the manual for courts martial. And it's precisely these circumstances that should provide a defense to the disobedience of these orders.
The military judge didn't find that the conditions were tantamount to confinement, did he?
He did, Your Honor.
Specifically?
On page 112 and 113, 143 days of restriction was tantamount to confinement. And then he gave appellant a total of 177 days of credit.
Go ahead. Finish your credit.
So, in fact, he did find it tantamount to confinement in this case.
Counsel, regardless of error, assuming arguendo there's error, how can you find any prejudice here? He got 177 days confinement for restriction against 180 days of confinement. Eventually, he might have served 3 months of hard labor without. He's already gotten his DD reduced to a BCD. Where's the prejudice? He's already gotten very substantial relief. Where's the prejudice?
He also has 7 convictions for disobedience to lawful orders, Your Honor. And if the members had been presented with perhaps just 3 obstruction of justice offenses, those 3 offenses that appellant has not challenged before this court, it is possible that he wouldn't have spent that time at hard labor. It is possible that he doesn't receive a bad conduct discharge. So it was appellant's position that there certainly is prejudice in this case, even in light of the relief that was granted by the lower court for the violation of speedy review pursuant to its Article 66 TARDIF authority.
Counsel, does the record reflect anywhere that your client, when he was late for muster or when he was riding in the cars or driving the cars in violation of the restriction order, that when he took that action, he was doing so because he felt it was an unlawful order?
There is nothing in the record to suggest that, Your Honor. But there also is nothing in this court's case law to suggest that an appellant have a subjective belief that an order is unlawful to serve as that defense later at a court-martial.
So they need not take the action on the basis that it was an unlawful order at the time, that later on appeal they can argue that their actions were taken, I guess retroactively they can argue, because they didn't have to conform with it because it was illegal, even if they didn't know that at the time.
Well, Your Honor, he doesn't raise it for the first time on appeal. He does raise it for the first time at trial on page 113. And the answer to that is yes, Your Honor. If an order is patently illegal, violates Article 13 as this order does, then it is an absolute defense to the disobedience offense, regardless of whether the appellant believed it to be lawful at the time or not.
Did the military judge find that the conditions that he was charged with violating, the muster conditions and driving in a car, that those provisions were unduly onerous and were not required? Or did he find that it was a supervised visit, the supervised visitation with the wife, the telephone calls with the counsel being monitored, and that he was birthed in substandard housing?
The answer to your question, again, is on page 112. He discusses those specific provisions that you just referenced. But then in the final paragraph, he says, finally, the terms of early max restriction, particularly the requirements which did not directly serve the purposes of ensuring his presence at trial, were unnecessary and unduly onerous. He's finding this entire order to be unlawful, and that's a plain reading of that sentence. He goes on in that same paragraph to say that they required him to muster in Barracks 215, not in a specific squadron. The government itself placed him in an area with persons serving punishment, persons stigmatized with pending charges and misconduct. And in the final sentence, he was restrained from the freedom of movements and unduly restricted from activities which serve no legitimate government purpose. And it is these exact conditions, the musters and riding in an automobile, that squarely fall within that.
You don't think that having people on restriction muster throughout the day is an ordinary thing when someone's placed on pretrial restriction?
It is, Your Honor.
And you don't think that helps ensure their presence for trial and ensure that the command's able to keep them under supervision?
It most certainly does, Your Honor. And as I said in response to Judge Baker's question, if this was just a situation where he was required to muster outside, say, his squadron commander's office once, twice, 3 times, maybe 4 times a day, we may have a legitimate debate on our hands with the government. We do not have that in this case, where not only is he being required to muster outside the CO's office, but he's being required to do so with adjudged restrictees, I mean, that are serving punitive restricted man's musters. And that should instruct this court as to the real purpose underlying the appellant's presence at those...
Wait a minute. You're saying that because he was commingled in mustering? Are you saying that because he was commingled in mustering, or because he mustered in this ratty building, or what?
All of that.
All of that. The totality of the circumstances.
The totality of the circumstances.
Okay, well...
So the command should have to have separate musters? They should have to have the OOD or a command representative show up at 10 different times so that they can have some people on restriction muster at one time, one set of times, and the other people at another time?
Well, Your Honor,
is that what you think that is required?
We will be discussing 2 separate musters. If the command wished to have the adjudged restrictees muster in Barracks 215, they may do so. They may not require appellants to muster at those punitive musters. That is appellant's position, yes, Your Honor. In conducting its de novo review of the orders in this case today, this court is in the position of the military judge at page 113, where the military judge has found the order to violate Article 13, and the court now conducts its de novo review with that ruling in mind and determines the lawfulness of this order. It's truncated analysis, and it's a very simple answer. This order does, in fact, violate Article 13. Now, it's important to note here that the government has never challenged that this order violates Article 13. They've never challenged it at the lower court, and they do not do so in the brief before this court. On pages 9 and 10, they say that appellant really, the way they use this conflates these two issues, which are in fact separate issues according to the government. The law of the case doctrine should prevent this court from reexamining the Article 13 issue that has not been challenged at the lower court or before this court. A case on point is the Gentle case, which I referenced earlier, where this court, having determined, or actually the reviewing authority in that case, it's at head note 2, found the restriction not to be authorized by the code. The court did not disturb that ruling, treated that ruling, which would traditionally be a conclusion of law, as a conclusion of fact, and then conducted its legality analysis, accepting that conclusion of fact. The ruling of the military judge, according to the law of the case doctrine, is neither clearly erroneous nor would work a manifest injustice, and again, this court should not disturb the Article 13 ruling.
With respect to the Article 13 ruling, were there any conditions of pretrial restriction which the judge either approved or didn't address?
The plain language on page 112 suggests no, Your Honor. The terms of Airman Max restriction, particularly requirements did not directly serve the purpose of ensuring his presence at trial, were unduly erroneous. And so that suggests the entire order is illegal, and particularly these provisions.
I'm trying to figure out whether the judge was determining that no conditions of restriction could be imposed on this individual under these circumstances, or that each and every one of the conditions here was improper.
I think the answer to your question, Your Honor, is each and every one of the conditions here were improper. Certainly restriction could have been imposed upon Airman Mack in accordance with RCN 304. RCN 304 and Article 13, however, were not complied with, and that these circumstances and the conditions that were in fact imposed were more rigorous than necessary.
What was the command supposed to do?
Your Honor, they could place him in pretrial restriction and require him to muster and place additional conditions on him that were not more rigorous than necessary to ensure his...
But what you're saying is that everything they did in this case was wrong.
That's right, Your Honor. Okay. Everything in that restriction order is in fact wrong. And it would appear that what the command did is they took their normal punitive restriction order that they were given to the other residents of Barracks 215, added further onerous conditions on this, such as you will not use the phone, you will not ride in a car, and went from there. This is a punitive order that was given to appellant to...
Are you saying everything was wrong, or that it was wrong because it was done in conjunction with the punitive process in the building and so on? Are you really saying that you can't have someone muster who's thought might be a drug dealer, and you're not allowed to take their cell phone away from them?
No, not at all, Your Honor. Those conditions could have been imposed, but they were not imposed.
I'm just trying to clarify which is your answer here.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, the command could have imposed lawful restriction conditions on the appellant, a certain amount of mustering, some minimal amount of restraint to ensure appellant's presence at trial. That is not what happened in this case.
And they can take the cell phone or limit access to opportunities to use a cell phone in private.
Yes, Your Honor, in private. But again, that's not what happened in this case.
No, I understand. I just want to make sure. I want to see how far, whether you're...
Can they restrict you from driving a car?
Perhaps for driving a car, Your Honor, but that's not what happened in this case. It was for getting inside of a car. Could appellant have been given a ride from one of his trustworthy friends at this water? Is there a way that this order could have been more narrowly tailored? And most certainly there is. Appellant was not accused of conspiring with any other service members to distribute drugs, and there were more less restrictive means by which the government could have tailored this order. Remember the words of Sergeant Major Roberts on page 84, that restriction is not fun, and the words of his de facto jailers on pages 488 and 492, that restriction is restriction. We know that restriction is not restriction, confinement is not confinement, and this court should set aside these convictions because Bingham requires it, but also to send a message to the Sergeant Major Rogers and the Lieutenant Colonel Keynes that is the case, and they must conform their conduct to Article 13 of the Uniform Code.
Well, does that mean that every violation of RCM 304 would entitle an individual to disobey any of the terms?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. As you point out in your separate opinion and me, there are probably more questions in this area of law than there are answers, specifically when we start talking about regulatory violations. This isn't necessarily a regulatory violation. It is a statutory violation in that it imposed conditions more rigorous than necessary to ensure appellant's presence at this trial. If I may turn to
why would there be a difference between regulatory and statutory violations under these circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, it arguably violates RCM 304. It plainly violates Article 13. RCM 304 should have the force of law, and there should be no difference in this case. It is possible that we can get into lower directives, perhaps, and there may be a debatable issue here. This is not...
Let's take RCM 304. It says, the order to an officer or civilian shall be delivered personally by the authority who issues it or by another commissioned officer. If an enlisted person delivered an order on restriction, would that then entitle the officer to disobey it?
I'm sorry, if an
enlisted person delivered an order to restriction to an officer, would the officer be entitled to disobey it on the grounds that he can only be served by another officer?
If it was an otherwise validly imposed condition of restriction, I do not believe so, Your Honor. That is, again, not what is at issue in this case. If I may briefly turn to the second issue. There must be evidence in this case which, taken in the light most favorable to the government, could convince a reasonable court member that the appellant and his co-conspirator both possessed the mental state required for the offense which was the object of this conspiracy, in this case, the specific intent to impede appellant's court-martial. The Fifth Circuit in Pearson stated that the existence of a co-conspirator is not only a required element of the crime, it is the essence of the crime. And the Eleventh Circuit in Chandler has stated that the proof of a true agreement is the only way to prevent individuals who are not actually members of the group from being swept into the conspiratorial net. Now, appellant is at somewhat of a disadvantage in this case in defending against this conspiracy charge because, like the Chandler case, the government's theory of conspiracy appears to be somewhat in flux. The Chandler court refers to this as a rogue.
Did he request a bill of particulars or clarification?
He did not, Your Honor, because the government's theory of conspiracy at trial was clear. It was dealing with prosecution exhibits 13 and 14, and therefore it is... It was not necessary at trial.
So he didn't request to know further who John or Jane Doe was?
He did not, Your Honor, because it was plain at trial, but just as happened in the Chandler's case.
It was plain there was someone named Doe?
Well, it was plain what the government's theory was, which was the mailing of prosecution exhibits 13 and 14. We now have three theories, as at my last count, that the government has advanced before this court. The mailing of the package, the second theory involving Jane Doe on a telephone call, and then a third reference to Pellet conspiring with known drug dealers in the Angola region around the base.
Isn't your real issue on this one the Jackson-Turner standard? What's your best argument as to that's not exactly the highest standard in the world of appellate review?
It isn't, Your Honor, but we can meet it in this case. The appellant can meet it.
What's your best argument or your best two arguments?
There is no proof of an agreement between any of these alleged co-conspirators. In some cases, there's no even evidence to suggest that a co-conspirator existed. According to two of the theories, we certainly have suggested that co-conspirators existed, but these are co-conspirators that are being swept into this conspiratorial net where there's no evidence that there was, in fact, an agreement between appellant and the alleged co-conspirators.
What about the telephone call in which there was a female participating in the background? Under a Jackson theory, why isn't that sufficient for the members to infer that he was acting in concert with that individual?
Because there should be evidence of an agreement, Your Honor. And if you closely examine what Mrs. Rogers' testimony was, Your Honor, we're about to run out of time here, if I can answer
the question.
If you look closely at what she says, and this alleged co-conspirator that is trying to encourage appellant or aid appellant in obstructing justice through the telephone, her exact words are, no, stop that, not on the phone. And then she picks up the phone and gives some information that is arguably intended to mislead. And no, stop that is hardly evidence that this individual wanted that phone call, that threat to take place in that manner that he did.
That concludes your time. Do you have further questions?
Just one more follow-up. If, in fact, the telephone number that she gave was intended to mislead, doesn't that indicate that she was in concert with the defendant in his obstruction?
It does not, Your Honor. All it suggests is that, at most, that she intended that he not be caught after she learns of this plot. And I suspect that if I were to go home this evening and make a threatening phone call to A&2 DeBose or someone else, and my wife happened to come in, she may say something like, no, stop that, what are you doing, not on the phone, and then pick up the phone and give this sort of misleading information. That does not mean that my wife is a co-conspirator.
Even if we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the government.
Even if we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, Your Honor.
Do you think that it makes it has any bearing on this issue that the government knew that your client was on restriction, was not supposed to use a phone, was not supposed to get in the car, and that somehow these phone calls were being made and things were being mailed?
Does that weigh in on the first issue?
No, on the second issue. I mean, someone's making phone calls and someone is mailing things, and didn't the members know that your client was, at least in theory, on restriction, not allowed to use a phone, not allowed to use a car, etc.?
They did, Your Honor, and for three of the specifications that appellant does not challenge before this court, the members convicted appellant of making those phone calls as Robert. From his home, and the prosecution exhibit 5 is appellant's phone records, which actually demonstrate that he was, in fact, making those phone calls from his home. Appellant can't fault the government for charging this case in the alternative that he was either acting as Robert and obstructing justice or conspiring Robert with obstructing justice. Appellant takes issue with the fact that appellant is convicted of both theories, that he is not only is Robert and is obstructing justice, but conspiring with Robert to obstruct justice. If there are no further questions, that concludes.
You'll have an opportunity to have a rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Captain Roger Mattioli, and I represent the United States. This court stated in United States versus Noy, fundamental to an effective armed force is the obligation of obedience to lawful orders. Appellant was restricted to the limits of Marine Corps Air Station New River, North Carolina, was required to muster 4 times a day on work days and 8 times a day on non-work days, and was prohibited from driving or riding in a car. Those orders were specifically aimed at ensuring appellant's presence at trial and were legal orders. When appellant failed to muster and drove and rode in a vehicle, he was guilty of breaking restriction. Although under D-shirt, it would appear that the
counsel. There's some comment in the record to the effect that restriction is not supposed to be fun.
from someone running the restriction. As I understand it, the military judge specifically found that this was not intended as punishment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is that the law of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. The military judge's finding the fact that there was no intent to punish on the behalf of the command.
Or could we look to that as an intention to punish? You know, it's not supposed to be fun, but it's supposed to ensure his presence for trial. That's two different things. It doesn't have to be fun, but not being, if you have a purpose to not make it fun in addition to the purpose of ensuring his presence for trial, isn't that punitive?
No, Your Honor, it is not. In fact, it is an accurate statement. Restriction is not intended to be fun. There's no requirement that it be fun. That is an accurate statement.
No, it's intended to ensure his presence for trial. Fun should be irrelevant.
That's exactly correct.
Well, then you've got somebody in charge of it saying it's not supposed to be fun.
I would not take exception to that statement, Your Honor. The military judge considered that. He stated that on the record. He listened to that same testimony, and he found that there was no intent to punish.
He said the purpose of the order was to ensure presence at trial. So is the government's view that the order was not related to potential drug use and preventing future misconduct?
There was were portions, limitations that were in the restriction order that were specifically aimed at as the...
But you said that the purpose was to make sure he showed up at trial. Are you arguing both or just the one?
It is clear here that the order was lawful under Article those orders of which appellant was convicted were lawful based solely on that reading of Article 13. In other words, they were aimed specifically at ensuring.
So the government is not arguing today that the order is lawful because of some other purpose that may have been present.
That is also an additional argument. It is true that under the United States versus...
I'm not trying to feed you arguments. I'm trying to ask you what your argument is.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I do have that later on. But under the United States versus Bly, under the United States versus Gentle, and under the jurisprudence of this court as well as RCM 304, there are other legitimate purposes.
And where are they reflected in the record?
They are reflected in the Sergeant Major's testimony, Your Honor, at... if you could give me just one moment... where he testifies that that the appellant was restricted because Lieutenant Colonel Kane felt it was confinement was necessary and later restriction because of risk of flight, safety of the command, and the cooperating witnesses' safety. That's record at page 78.
Anything else on that issue, on that point?
On his concerns regarding
right,
safety.
The purpose of the order.
Besides Sergeant Major's testimony, Your Honor.
I'm just asking to catalog your facts.
I don't believe there's anything additional in addition to the investigating officer's report and the report from Special Agent Roberts, where he talks about the control by, where he talks about the fact that it happened in a vehicle. It goes through that whole litany and talks about that. So there's the Special Agent's report, there's Sergeant Major Rogers' testimony, all of that, and his statements that Lieutenant Colonel Kane considered all of that.
The 143 days credit that was ordered in this case, was that a correct decision or an error by the military judge?
Your Honor, the government is not challenging that position at this time because, again, the appellant was not convicted of any of those limitations, of any portions of that. He was given credit because of the conditions in restriction barracks. He was given credit because of the monitoring phone call specifically to his wife and because, of the supervised visitation periods with his wife, the monitoring of telephone calls, particularly those involving calls to appellant's counsel, and the conditions in the restriction barracks. He's not staying here today convicted of violating any of those provisions. He's found guilty of violating specific muster provisions and of violating the orders to ride in and drive a car. Those were clearly legal orders, and so there.
So when you read the military judge's order on a decision on page 112 of the record, which says the terms of the restriction, particularly requirements which did not directly serve the purpose of ensuring his presence at trial, were unnecessary, unduly onerous. How do we know that the judge, in using those terms, blessed portions of the restriction and not others? That is, the judge emphasized, it looks to me, at least in terms of the specific words the judge used, that he emphasized certain portions of the restriction, but it's not apparent to me that he said that any portions of the restriction were lawful.
Well, if we go back and look at the entire findings of fact and conclusion of the military judge, going back, I think it's from 109 through 112, he talks about the specific provisions. He talks about the fact that it was not the command's intent to punish. He goes through and lists the provisions, and then he makes that finding and talks about what he found that was in violation of Article 13. And that the government's argument that that was not a finding of fact, that the entire order violated Article 13, is strengthened if you look to page 558 in the record, where he later is considering the defense's motion for a finding of not guilty based on the illegality of the orders. And he specifically states that he looked at United States versus New, and that is where he states that he thinks it's a mixed question of law and fact, and that it's appropriate for the members to resolve. And he states, I will not make findings as to the matter of law as to the legality of either the decision to place Airman Mack in restriction, in pretrial restriction, or the terms of that restriction and whether or not they were overboard. So he specifically there is stating, I have not made a finding of fact as to whether this restriction order violates Article 13.
Well, but that would be a conclusion of law and not a finding of fact. So it's not clear what he's talking about there.
It is not, Your Honor, but again, if this court...
So why should we rely on a statement by the military judge that reflects, at that point, an incorrect view of the law?
Well, that's an incorrect reading of the law as to whether or not he should submit the matter to the members.
Well, it's also an incorrect reading of the law as to whether it's an issue of law or an issue of fact, whether those circumstances violated Article 13 is a question of law. There may be subsidiary questions of fact in there. I'm looking at that same material on that page and trying to figure out which aspects of the order he wanted to bless and which ones he didn't. It looks like he threw up his hands and said, well, now that you're asking me to look at the issue from the perspective of violation of the order, I'm not going to address anything, including those items which I previously specifically pointed out as violations of Article 13. He didn't even want to say at that point that those were violations.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the government is not, the government is conceding the fact that was error under United States versus Deischer. However, Deischer states that this court and the lower court can look directly to the order and decide whether the order was legal. Here, the orders, the muster provisions, and the order not to ride in or drive a car were clearly legal orders.
The appellant's response to that is, what the restriction is, the restriction might have been fine, but not in conjunction with being at that excellent 8th and I barracks.
Yes, Your
Honor. What's your response to that?
My response is that the condition...
It's not a lawful order, the appellant's arguing, because, because it was dressed up, or... depending on how you describe it, not dressed up at this dumpy barracks and with all the punitive people.
First of all, the government concedes that the Marine Corps doesn't have the best installations everywhere, and there's a lot of testimony in the record as to the fact that there were rundown barracks all over that base, and that they were overflowing at the other barracks, and that's why they...
So is it the government's position that this is Marine Corps standard barracks? Is that the kind of barracks you ran?
It may not have been up to Marine Corps ideals. However, there are a lot of installations.
How about just Marine Corps standards?
Regardless, Your Honor, it's not relevant to the fact that the...
Well, it's relevant to their argument, and you have to now say why that's not a winning argument and
because
so on.
It simply required him to muster in that place, Your Honor. If the appellant, for example, had taken issue with the fact that he was ordered to live in those conditions and had refused to live in those conditions and had then gone into court and said, I refuse to live here because of these conditions, perhaps he would have a case. But simply being ordered to muster somewhere and sign in and sign out, the condition of the barracks is irrelevant as to those muster provisions.
What about the commingling?
Again, Your Honor, the commingling was something that the military judge gave confinement credit for and found that it did violate Article 13, but that's a different provision. It is separate from muster provision and an order to ride or drive in a car. An appellant cannot stand here today and order that.
No, I'm talking about the commingling at the muster. The appellant is maintaining that he was forced to muster with those other guys, and that itself was unlawful.
I understand the question now, Your Honor. The answer to that is that all pretrial restrictees were ordered to muster. The Sergeant Major Rogers' testimony at page 85 and specifically at page 87 says that the...
Well, just because all of them were required to, does that make it lawful?
No, it does not. However, Your Honor, pretrial restrictees as a condition in order to ensure that they're not leaving the base, that they have not fled.
They conceded that mustering was lawful. Their complaint was that they were commingled in the muster.
Again, Your Honor, it would have to be a clearly illegal provision, and simply having all the individuals who are restricted show up to show that they are present.
At one time as opposed to two times?
Exactly. It is not, does not make the order clearly illegal, Your Honor.
Counsel, what's the legal effect of a military judge finding that an order is completely or partially in violation of Article 13? What is the effect of that determination on a determination as to whether it was a lawful order?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I understand the question correctly. In the case of a restriction, this court can look to United States versus Bly. In that case, the appellant, I believe, was charged with five specifications of breaking restriction. The appellant in that case was ordered not to leave the confines of Fort Bliss and not to drink. And he was found on four separate occasions outside of the confines of Fort Bliss at a bar. On the final occasion, they did a breathalyzer and found that he was intoxicated, and so charged him with all of those, with four specifications of being outside the confines of Fort Bliss and one of drinking in violation of the other term of the restriction. Both of those were terms of the restriction. However, the court only took issue with whether or not the order, they dealt them as separate orders. The order within the restriction not to drink was, in fact, a lawful order. In that case, the court found that it was, so there was no question as to the legality of the order. However, it would be completely irrational for the court to hold that the order not to leave the confines of Fort Bliss was illegal because a separate provision of the restriction was illegal. It was only those provisions that are found to be illegal that are then cannot be enforced under a rules violation or orders violation.
So is the government conceding that in some circumstances a finding that an order violates Article 13 could render an order illegal?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Had the military judge in this case stated that he found that the provision for riding in a motor vehicle violated Article 13, had he found that on the record and had the government not challenged that, and that was the holding here today, perhaps then appellant could not be convicted of that because it would be in direct violation to the military judge's finding. However, that's not what we have here in this case.
But in every case, you have to do the full analysis as to whether an order is legal or lawful or unlawful.
Exactly, Your Honor, each provision of a restriction order.
And what you're saying is that in some circumstances, the fact that an order was found to be in violation of Article 13 would mean that it is unlawful?
Yes, Your Honor. That could be the case. It is not the case here, however, with the muster provisions.
And just so I'm clear, what are those circumstances, if you could, that an Article 13 violation would render an order unlawful?
Well, for example, the defense relies on United States versus Bayhand, provides a good example, an order that during restriction you are going to break rocks with the other prisoners, that's something that's imposed as punishment. If that's put in the restriction order, it's clearly illegal and it would be a violation of Article 13, and therefore later the government could not properly convict Private Bayhand of not breaking rocks. Bayhand's a perfect example, Your Honor.
Counsel, Deischer, as I understand it, gives us the option of determining the lawfulness of the order at the appellate level, but is it a requirement that we do so?
It does not appear to be a requirement in Deischer, Your Honor.
And in a case such as this, where we have the ruling of the military judge, what leaves us somewhat at sea as to which portions of the order the judge determined to be unlawful or not, and in which we have the problem of the manner in which the judge sought to resolve the relationship between the factual and legal issues at trial, why shouldn't we say this case might be one in which an individual could be convicted, but that sorting out process, since it's so fact-bound, should take place at the trial level by first having the judge who hears the witnesses and observes the evidence decide which parts of the order are or are not lawful, and then secondly, specifically determining which factual questions should be submitted to the members. Why should we go through that process here when we have a discretion as to whether to do it or not, and we have a case in which the multiple aspects of the judge's ruling leave us somewhat at sea as to what happened?
Yes, Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, in almost every case the military where there is error of this type from the military judge, it is going to be for those reasons. The government would argue in this case that the orders are so clearly lawful that there is no reason for it to be sent down. It's really not that fact-dependent. Were the appellant convicted of some of the circumstances that the military judge was talking about, the visits with his wife or the monitored phone calls, etc., then you might have that mixed question of law and fact, and then it might be appropriate to send that down, but not in a case where the orders are so clearly lawful. This court can certainly determine that an order to muster 4 times a day on working days, 8 times a day on non-working days, and not to drive in a vehicle for someone who was known or was suspected of selling drugs from his vehicle and out in town, those are clearly lawful orders. They're clearly made to ensure the appellant's presence at trial, and so therefore there is no reason for this court, just as the lower court did not do, to send this case back down, even though the military judge erred.
And even though there's a possibility in this case, as distinguished from a direct order case, that the military judge in fact ruled that the entirety was of the restriction was unlawful. I know you're not conceding that, but we do have a significant ambiguity in the judge's ruling here.
Again, Your Honor, as you stated, the government is not conceding that the military judge found that. If you read the entirety of those pages 109 through 112 in the record, it is clear that he is not stating that the entire restriction was illegal, and that's specifically bolstered by the fact that he found no intent to punish, and that he stated specifically those three reasons were the reason why the restriction was unduly onerous. If you had the case where the military judge did say that the entire restriction order was illegal, then perhaps that would be a case where it would have to be sent back down. But that's not the case we have before us. If there are no further questions on issue one.
Well, one further question on that. In United States against Gray, our court was a case that involved escape from confinement. And our court held that since the confinement was illegally imposed in that case, he could not be charged with escape for confinement. If we were to decide in this case, you've invited us to review the legality of the order, and without conceding that, if we were to decide that the entire restriction was illegally imposed, what's the implication as far as the underlying charges for violating the restriction?
If this court were determined that the restriction order was illegal, then appellant could not be convicted of breaking restriction.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on to issue two, considering the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution and drawing every favorable inference from the record in favor of the prosecution, the members could reasonably have found, as they did, that appellant conspired with an unknown person to obstruct justice by threatening John DeBose, a government witness. Now, appellant discussed in great detail the fact that there was no direct evidence of an agreement in this case. However, as this court has recognized, the existence of a conspiracy need not take any particular form or be manifested in any form or words. That's Cobb. And in the other jurisprudence, Barnes, Matthias, this court has stated that that since a conspiracy is normally done in secret, you very rarely have a case where you will have direct evidence of an agreement. However, circumstantial evidence is sufficient, and there is a great deal of circumstantial evidence in this case, which shows that there was an agreement to threaten Mr. DeBose. You have the 17 January 2001 phone call from an individual claiming to be Robert, and the phone records show that the phone call came from appellant's home. He called and stated that he and several other individuals had a $10,000 hit on Mr. DeBose's head if he testified, and that they knew where his parents lived and there would be bloodshed there. That's record at page 463 in Prosecution Exhibit 6 of the phone records. You have testimony regarding the existence of those individuals named in the phone call as civilian drug dealers who operated in Onslow County, North Carolina. That was Special Agent Roberts and John DeBose. And the death threat that was sent from Georgia with bullets in it, which refers to appellant as my partner, and says, we'll also see to it that your address and phone number will be well known. Again, more circumstantial evidence of an agreement. At record page 759, the defense concedes that the record came, or that the package was sent from Georgia. And Prosecution Exhibit 8 is the envelope that it was sent in. On February 12th, the appellant called to confirm that Mr. DeBose had received the package that was mailed from Georgia.
So those are all. I may be misremembering the facts, but I thought that the return address was from Georgia, but that the postmark was not capable of being read correctly. Am I wrong about that?
No, that is absolutely accurate, Your Honor. But again, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, that package was sent from Techwood, Georgia.
And so the could reason. Wait, they can't read the postmark, but they concede it was sent from Georgia?
That is correct, Your Honor. The postmark is illegible, however. At record at page 759, defense counsel gets up and states that package came from Georgia. That's in his closing argument.
So that's in the evidence, or is that his closing argument?
It's his closing argument, Your Honor.
So what evidence is there that what came from Georgia?
There's the return address on the package, Your Honor, as well as the testimony that Mr. DeBose had conversations with appellant, that he was from Georgia, that he knew people in Georgia, that he was from, I think, Henrietta, Georgia.
So in that case, the co-conspirator is in fact John Doe.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Or Jane Doe, the mailer.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what act did he commit that he was convicted of with respect to that package?
The appellant, Your Honor, he was convicted of, if you give me just one moment, I can get the actual charges. He was convicted of a conspiracy, and he was convicted of threatening John DeBose. The obstruction charges, specification 10, by communicating to the said John DeBose a threat to kill the said John DeBose and his family if he testified at such court-martial.
And not convicted of anything with respect to sending the package other than conspiracy?
There is the specification 12, where it says that by communicating a threat to kill said John DeBose by mailing to Mr. DeBose two bullets with his name written on.
Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. However, there was aiding and abetting possibility out there that members could have convicted Mr. DuBose for entering into this conspiracy to threaten, and they could have found that the conspirator sent the package and that Mr. DuBose was, or excuse me, that appellant was liable for the mailing of that package.
And where in the record does the government introduce evidence of that activity, the aiding and abetting?
They don't directly introduce that, Your Honor. However, again, they introduce evidence of the agreement. They introduce evidence that the package was mailed from this Georgia address. They introduce evidence that the appellant made a phone call to ensure that the package was mailed.
Did the government argue an aiding and abetting theory here that say to the members, well, you can convict him even though he didn't physically send the package because he was aiding and abetting somebody else? Where does the government argue that?
I don't remember if he specifically argued that, Your Honor. I do know that he talks about the co-conspirator liability in his closing argument. I would have to look at that and get back.
I'm just trying to figure out where we get to the Jackson standard on that particular aspect of the mailing, if the government hasn't even offered a theory that there's an aiding and abetting out there.
Yes, Your Honor. However, even if the court were to find that appellant, I guess it would be that appellant himself mailed that package, you still have the two phone calls that came from his house, and you still have the fact that he later called with this unknown female in the...
The female named John.
Yes, Your Honor, there is no requirement that the government charge Jane Doe or John Doe. The identity can be unknown, that's well known. The conspirator's sex does not have to be known or charged by the government. And there are numerous cases that state that John Doe is a proper way of charging an unknown person in a conspiracy. Discussing the unknown female, as appellant pointed out, the phone call came and Mrs. Roberts, Mr. DuBose's mother, was actually heard the woman in the background what was later identified as appellant made the remark that, did you get my mail? At that point, she then grabs the phone and does say, no, not on the phone, don't say that, and then gets up and says, bitch, don't call, my number is, gives what is later determined to be a fake number, and hangs up. And again, that is evidence, circumstantial evidence, that she knew that she had agreed to be present for this phone call, and then after the, not threats, but after the statement was made, did you get my mail, which can certainly be considered a threat when it is construed with the contents of that package, she then grabs the phone and, as the defense stated, makes an attempt to conceal that activity. Again, that is circumstantial evidence of the conspiracy and of the agreement to threaten Mr. DuBose. The United States can put on evidence of one person or multiple people, and each can have a separate connection to the crime or the criminal purpose. That's the trial counsel did that here. He properly argued that the co-conspirators could have been the other drug dealers or the female caller. That is in the record at page 742, where he does actually make that argument. There was, as was stated earlier, no bill of particulars request under RCM 906B6 anywhere in the record. And so, therefore, the government properly put forward this theory in argument and in evidence at trial. Appellant's repeated admissions that he was working with known drug dealers to, quote, put a hit out on Mr. DuBose if he testified at appellant's court-martial, and his references to the written death threat mailed to Mr. DuBose by unknown individuals are sufficient to prove that appellant conspired with those individuals to threaten Mr. DuBose. Even were they not, the phone call in which an unidentified female caller assists appellant in an attempt to conceal his identity while making a threat was also legally sufficient. As the First Circuit stated in United States v. Ruiz, although the evidence does not compel a finding of guilt, it need not exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence or be wholly inconsistent with every conclusion except guilt. The jury was, quote, free to choose among reasonable constructions of the evidence, and the trial evidence as a whole permits a conclusion of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, as the lower court properly held. As such, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence as adjudged, approved, and affirmed below. If there are no other questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
If I can, just very briefly, to answer hopefully your question, Judge Erdman, with respect to the government's theory of conspiracy. This all takes place on page 469 of the record, where Mrs. Rogers is testifying as to what she believes that she heard during this phone call involving the female caller, Jane Doe. It's important to note, though, that mere presence at the scene of a crime does not establish conspiracy, and even under the Jackson-Turner analysis, this court concludes that these actions which were taken to aid and abet appellant in making this phone call in obstructing justice, they take place after the alleged overt act in this case, in accordance with Witten, cannot establish a conspiracy because she joins the conspiracy after the threat takes place. And so therefore, that theory must fail that the government advances in this case. So it's a two-tiered argument that does not satisfy the elements of conspiracy, and even if it does, it takes place at the wrong time to satisfy the conspiracy, rather. With respect to the third theory advanced by the government, that he knew, appellant knew drug dealers, and that he entered into an agreement with the drug dealers, appellant invites this court to read carefully the death threat that is sent in Prosecution Exhibits 13 and 14. A careful reading is that there are drug dealers out there to get you, but there is no evidence, even under Jackson Turner, that appellant knows that these drug dealers exist, or he knows that they exist, but does not know them and is actually in a conspiracy to obstruct justice in this case. The record is devoid of any evidence that appellant is working with these drug dealers to threaten John DeBow or his family.
So we're supposed to believe that these drug dealers, with no connection, I mean, if they exist at all, but with no communication or connection with your client, are intent on preventing DeBose from testifying just out of the goodness of their hearts, or what would be their rationale for doing that?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have any independent evidence that there was, other than from appellant's note, that these drug dealers did actually desire to...
Well, we have that, and so given that as a basis, he's saying that they're out there and that they're out to get you, and the idea is that we don't want you to testify. Now, if there had been no communication, what possible reason would these unknown people have to be after?
Your Honor, the record, and I go into great depth of this in the brief submitted to the lower court, John DeBow's drug involvement. By the time he leaves the military, gets his general discharge for cooperating with NCIS in this case, he already has another felony drug conviction in the state of Georgia with cocaine distribution. So this is a very, John DeBow is a very interesting
active
character.
Active person.
In narcotics offenses, I mean, they go to clean out his trailer, and his command sergeant major says that they find cocaine paraphernalia and cocaine in his trailer as he's getting his general discharge. And so this is a person that certainly would have these types of enemies out there. He is certainly heavily involved in narcotics. In fact, after he becomes a government informant, he has to go to the hospital because he gets pulled over after the first controlled buy in this case because he swallows balloons containing cocaine. I mean, this is an individual that is neck deep in narcotics. And so Bookie, Wild Child, Jap, these individuals, if they do in fact exist, as the NCIS agent testifies, they have more than enough interest in silencing John DeBose themselves. It is important that this record must demonstrate that these drug dealers are in agreement with the appellant to obstruct justice. They have an independent reason all their own to silence John DeBose, and this record more than amply demonstrates that reason, and that is John DeBose's misconduct himself.
Well, and I understand that that's one way to look at the evidence, but can't we look at it another way, the way that Judge Erman suggested, which is that looking at that letter that the jury could infer from it that they must have had an agreement with your client?
Your Honor, I believe that stretches Jackson Turner too far. That does not even satisfy circumstantial evidence that there is an agreement with the appellant. He references drug dealers, but again, there is no reference. He says these drug dealers are out to get you. He doesn't say that I'm working with these drug dealers to get you. I'm threatening you myself. He makes those threats himself. And there's more than enough evidence in this record that appellant obstructed justice himself, but there's not even circumstantial evidence to suggest that he conspired with anyone to do it. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10 minutes after 10 o'clock. Our second case today is United States against Moran. Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Zephon, honorable members of the court. Good morning, my name is Captain Anthony Ortiz, and together with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class David Moran. In the present case, the issues involve whether the repeated references to the appellant's exercise of his constitutional rights can survive constitutional scrutiny. The references to these rights occur throughout the entire trial, in opening, during findings, and in closing argument. It is not the mere use of them that is troubling in this case, but the use of them as substantive evidence of guilt. Based on this, their use should be deemed impermissible, especially in light of the military judge's failure to give a curative instruction. As such, the members' findings in this case are highly questionable and should require reversal. Addressing the original issue, and specified issue one, is the use of the constitutional right to the reference is impermissible even if to establish chronology or background. Our first position is that it was not used as merely background information, but substantive evidence of guilt adverse to Griffin v. California. Trial counsel, again, emphasized the use of it as substantive evidence by forwarding a...
Wait, what's your answer to the question, however? What if, conceding just for the sake of argument, that it wasn't used as substantive evidence of guilt?
The mere use of as background evidence or chronology, Your Honor, would be impermissible based on case law, MRE 402, and MRE 301 F3.
So, either way?
Yes, sir.
So any reference to the constitutional rights is reversible error as far as you're concerned? It's not only reversible, but it's plain error?
Yes, Your Honor. Not a singularity, but the use in this case throughout the entire trial.
Well, wait a minute, what are you saying? Are you saying that the whole thing on these facts amounts to error? Are you saying that any allusion to it is error?
That in this case, it is error.
Okay, so you're not saying that any allusion to it is error?
No. There are exceptions where constitutional rights may be referenced, and the hard and fast exceptions established by case law is if the defense opens the door to it. And there are other permissible uses. However, in this case, it was our position it was used as substantive evidence.
But I'm still asking you, putting that aside for the sake of argument, if it's not being used as substantive evidence and there are allusions to constitutional rights, let's say, where did you make the arrest? We arrested the person at the lawyer's office or whatever, I don't know, you know, pick your scenario. Do I understand you to say that that allusion alone is plain error?
Yes, Your Honor. And yes, Your Honor, if used as chronology or background evidence.
What if it was, we arrested him in church?
I'm sorry?
We arrested him in church, engaging in worship.
I would say no, Your Honor.
Isn't that a constitutional right?
I suppose it would be. However, the constitutional rights, especially that are addressed through case law, generally involve the Fifth, the Fourth Amendment, and the Sixth Amendment, as in this case.
So there are rights and rights for this purpose.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel, would you describe what the underlying policy is as to why certain rights, following on Judge Stuka's question, can be referred to, other rights cannot be referred to, and how that policy is implicated in this case?
I would say that the rights that are implicated, the Fourth, Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment in this case, are generally deemed inadmissible. That is because of the danger of misinterpretation, of using that evidence as an inference of guilt on the appellant's part. This is supported in United States v. Turner, where this court stated that yellow flags, if not red flags, should be apparent when, in response to a mere assertion by counsel during argument, the prosecution seeks to introduce evidence, especially when that evidence otherwise not only is not relevant, but is also subject to ready misinterpretations by a jury.
Okay, then please identify which statements could reasonably have been considered by the fact finder in this case as inferring the guilt of the appellant.
Certainly, Your Honor. On page 646, during Officer Frazier's testimony, when they asked him if they were able to make a collection of his body hair, and he stated he could not because he was en route to see his attorney in Hattiesburg. On page...
Well, then explain what the inference of guilt is there.
The inference of guilt in that case is that essentially based on the theme presented by prosecution is that the appellant was the jack of all crimes, that he was a career criminal, and that he was gaming the system and using his rights to thwart police investigation. In this case, the inference or the ready misinterpretation in that case is that he was using his attorney to thwart the police investigation.
Next statement.
Sorry?
Were there other statements?
Yes, sir. On the testimony of Special Agent Theodore Bourne on page 773, they asked him what method of authority were you using to get body hair, and the answer was initially we tried consent, and he didn't consent to us collecting body hair. The inference in that is that, again, based on the theme and based on the focus on closing arguments, that this was the most damning evidence, that he refused to consent and that he invoked his rights to an attorney, is again ready misinterpretation, that he was using his rights to game the system and thwart police investigation.
Well, wasn't that point actually used for a different point by the government, to show consciousness of guilt, to show that he knew that they wanted to get a hair sample, and then the next time that they see him, he has no hair at all?
The invocation of rights,
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you that it may have been done more artfully, but I mean, I'm not sure that it stands for the proposition that you're trying to make it stand for, that the fact that they asked that question was to show that he was a career criminal. I mean, I think what they were trying to do is show that he knew that they wanted a hair sample.
Yes, Your Honor, but this could have definitely been done in a more artful way, and certainly could have done...
Why don't you let us give us a hint as to how that questioning could have taken place without creating the problem you've identified.
Well, as noted by the amicus brief, this was not relevant. The I'm sorry?
Judge Ryan has suggested that the purpose was to set up a sequence of events here leading to the haircut.
Yes, sir.
And so if the trial counsel were to introduce evidence showing the sequence of events, what questions should the trial counsel have asked the witness in order to set up the sequence of events without encountering the problem that is of concern to you?
Well, essentially that they informed him that they wanted to seize his body hair. Him consenting.
Now, when did that happen? Was that at the first interview that they told him they wanted body hair?
Yes, Your Honor. On the 20th of March, 2001, they informed him that they wanted body hair and a urine sample. However, the government, in their closing argument, argued that he found out through friends, through dirty witnesses. Also, the testimony of Officer Joey Foray on page 29, when they asked him what happened when he got to the hospital, the response was, I offered him a consent form because the hospital requires some form of written verification, and he refused to sign it. Again, this was evidence that was readily misinterpreted, that because he did not consent, he was guilty of the crime of DUI.
Well, he had a blood alcohol content of 0.25, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Did the government argue in closing that was even after a period of time had elapsed?
I believe they did, Your Honor.
And wouldn't the statement that you just talked about help explain that time lapse?
Yes, Your Honor, but they still could have done it without referring to Appellant's invocation of constitutional rights.
How?
Basically by saying that there was a lapse of time between the accident and the collection of his blood.
Okay, and what do you do if one of the members asks about the lapse of time?
Well, I believe the military judge has a sua sponte duty to limit evidence of constitutional rights, and this is established in case law. Again, this court has stated that yellow or red flags should be flashing in a prosecutor's head when this is used as substantive evidence.
And then if the appellant's argument is the delay reflects poor police procedure, then you would argue that the door is opened?
Certainly, Your Honor. Probably the most egregious use of his constitutional rights was in closing argument when trial counsel characterized him refusing to consent and invoking his right to an attorney as the most damning evidence. And this is clearly outlawed in several cases, one being United States v. Fletcher. The military judge should have given a targeted curative instruction based on this. In Fletcher, this court held that the failure of the military judge not to give a curative instruction, despite no objection from counsel, was error. In assessing prejudice of trial counsel's improper argument, the court analyzed whether the military judge took curative measures. Despite the fact that the military judge gave a general limiting instruction, the court noted that it was not targeted and was not given in response to a statement or at the end of the argument. Like Fletcher, the military judge should have interrupted trial counsel in the argument. As this court stated, corrective instructions at an early point might have dispelled the taint of the initial remarks.
Counsel, even assuming that we agree with you that there was error and that the military judge also, that there was error in making the comments and that the military judge compounded the error by not giving a curative instruction, can you tell me specifically what the prejudice is with respect to all the charges on the charge sheet? For instance, Jostle, the charge of communicating a threat, wrongfully endeavoring to influence the testimony of Airman Gamble. What was her testimony at trial? Did she testify to his drug use?
I believe she testified merely that he had trashed her apartment. I believe that was the testimony. I don't believe that she testified to some drug use, but that was her main point of testimony.
Okay. I guess I don't... Tell me why this isn't harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because that's, I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road in this case for me.
Well, again, it's the prosecution's use of the theme that appellant was a jack of all crimes, that he was a career criminal, and that he was using the system.
Okay, well, let's say that I don't read the record that way. We're just talking about if you find that the statement should not have been made and that the military judge should have given a curative instruction, how is it error? I mean, how is it prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor, as expressed in the case law, there is a danger of the jury relying on that as an inference itself, and there's a reasonable possibility that it could have spilled over onto the remaining charges.
I mean, the obstruction of justice charge, I mean, they found him guilty, and she came in and testified that he made this threat, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the charge two, the driving while intoxicated, I mean, we had a lab result that he had a blood alcohol content of 0.25, right?
Yes, sir.
So, is it your view that these statements prejudiced him with respect to charge two and charge six?
Yes, sir. Our position is that this cannot be looked in singularity, that the reasonable probability, especially because it was expressed through opening, during findings, and in closing, is that it had a reasonable possibility that it could have affected all the charges. And that is language expressed in the United States v. Riley. In Riley, there was an invocation of Collins' Fifth Amendment rights approximately three times within a short time frame, and that was deemed as plain error, which required reversal. In this case, the raw numbers, if also referring to the appellant's jack-of-all-crimes thing, in opening argument, he referred to appellant as a jack-of-all-crimes twice. He referenced his exercise of his Fourth Amendment rights, specifically referencing his consent to draw once in the opening. During testimony, Officer Frazier mentioned him seeing his attorney once during direct. Officer Foray stated that he refused to consent to his blood test in both direct and cross-examination approximately two times. Special Agent Willen testified that he did not consent to taking the body hair once. Questions by members, two members asked what his explanation for shaving his body hair off. A military judge also inquired what his explanation for shaving his body hair off. In closing argument...
So wait, now you think that them commenting on the fact that he shaved his body hair off, that's incorrect or impermissible?
No, Your Honor. The explanation of why he shaved his body hair off.
Does he have a constitutional right to shave his body hair?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Does he have a constitutional right to shave his body?
Certainly not if it was obstruction of justice.
Right.
But the fact that he did not get a explanation and he invoked his right to remain silent is likely impermissible. Any closing argument, he referred to him as the jack of all crimes three times, referred to him not consenting to his blood test once, and stated that he wanted to see his attorney before executing a hair sample once. In total, it was approximately 16 times, given the trial counsel's screen, the witnesses' references to his invocation of rights, and the focusing of trial counsel in closing argument.
I guess one thing I'm having trouble with is how you tie the jack-of-all-crimes theme, why your arguments with respect to comments on his rights have anything to do with that theme.
Well, Your Honor, the comments should be viewed in context of the entire trial. The prosecution was essentially arguing that appellant was a criminal, that he knew the system, and that he was gaming the system. The interpretation by him focusing on the invocation of rights is that he was using that invocation of rights to game the system. The prejudice in this case is clear. The case was hotly contested with 30 witnesses. The members obviously had problems with witness credibility, and consent was a very important issue in this case. For charge 3, specification 6, appellant was charged with possession of marijuana and was found pursuant to search of his room. It was uncontested that the substance seized from the appellant's residence was marijuana. The fact that marijuana was found in his room was established by Special Agent Bourne and Mr. Loomer, the chemist. However, appellant did not take the stand. What the members likely took into account was that appellant consented to the search of his room. As trial counsel argued, now who would give consent to search a residence if they had marijuana in there and they knew that marijuana was in there? The fact that appellant consented was a likely distinguishing fact that caused the members to acquit him of the specification, and it is likely that the inverse was true. In other words, because appellant did not consent to the hair analysis or the withdrawal of blood, he was guilty of that offense. The members likely considered that he invoked his right to consent as evidence that he was guilty of drug offenses. In the words of Griffin, the prosecution, the military judge, made appellant's assertion of rights costly. Appellant was characterized as a criminal who was gaming the system. The present case should not be seen in merely as comments about themselves, but also within the pervasive theme of appellant's criminality mentioned at opening, closing, and rebuttal. It was information that was elicited by the witness, brought out by trial counsel, and elicited by the military judge. No instructions were given by the military judge, and the natural and irresistible impulse was the jury members assign a weight to his invocation of rights. Therefore, none of the remaining findings can be trusted. As such, appellant respectfully requests that this honorable court set aside the findings and sentence. Are there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. You'll have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I'm Captain Jamie Mendelson, and together with Major Kamani Eason, I represent the government in this case. The comments that appellant complains of were not introduced for the impermissible purpose of drawing an inference of guilt based on appellant's invocation or exercise of his constitutional and codal rights, but rather the evidence was admissible as part of the background sequence of events that led up to appellant's actions in shaving all of his body hair in order to avoid detection of his illegal drug use, as well as the steps taken to obtain a blood sample for blood alcohol testing.
Is that the test? Is the test whether or not the government introduced evidence of exercise of constitutional rights, whether they had the intent to do that, or do we look at what the effect on the members was in the context of the trial?
I think it ends up being a mixture of both, but the danger, the policy, is that it is unfair to allow testimony or to argue evidence that in response to a rights advisement during official questioning that an accused invokes his constitutional rights, and to argue that in that context as substantive evidence of guilt. So I think the danger is, it's probably looked at more from the perspective of, is there a danger there that the court members would attach some kind of inference of guilt based on an invocation of constitutional or Article 31 rights in that context?
So really we're not concerned with what the government intends. I mean, they could have very good intentions, but have slide over and impermissibly raise that issue, depending on the context.
That's correct, Your Honor. It would be the danger of any impermissible inference that the court members might draw upon.
I mean, it would be a pretty easy test if it was intent, because the government would get up in every case and say, no, we didn't have the intent.
That's
it's
correct.
More the effect than what they intended to do with their statement.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, the appellant is arguing that any reference to the exercise of constitutional rights is error, and in this case, plain error. Does one need to even look at the effect on members, and how can you judge that? So what is the standard? Any reference to the exercise of constitutional rights?
No, Your Honor, that's not the standard.
That's the standard that the appellant's arguing. What do you think the standard is?
The
Not the legal policy purposes, but what is the test that we should be applying to see if there's constitutional error here?
Well, the test to be applied is whether there is a danger that the court members were using those remarks or those comments as substantive evidence of guilt.
So there's a critical difference in legal view between you and the appellant appears to be whether there is the references to the constitutional rights are indicative of substantive evidence of guilt?
Yes, Your Honor. And this court has held before in cases that comments upon an accused's exercise of his constitutional rights can come into evidence, may be proper as part of a fair response or invited.
That's very different than saying that's a different issue because appellant's conceding that as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
The difference in legal view seems to be, on the one hand, reference to the invocation of rights is per se error, barring fair response and so on. And you're saying, no, it's not per se error. It depends whether it is introduced as substance of evidence of guilt.
Yes, sir.
Or I heard you in response to Judge Urban saying, or might be taken as such by members.
As substantive evidence of guilt, Your Honor.
Or maybe used, because how do you know whether it was used?
Well, and that's why this court's been clear that in looking at these kinds of comments, you have to look at them in the context of the trial as a whole. And that's the lens that you have to look at them through.
And what are you citing as your substantive evidence of guilt standard versus mere reference to invocation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a particular case?
In United States versus Gilley, this court commented that, using its analysis, its reasoning, that it's well settled that the government may not use a defendant's assertion of his Fifth Amendment rights as substantive evidence against him. And I believe that this court has repeated that in Haney.
But that's saying that something is well settled. It doesn't necessarily tell you where the line is that's closer to less well settled. Do you follow? I mean, the issue, what appellant's arguing here is that the mere invocation of the rights is error, and the fact that it's well settled that the purposeful reference to rights is error doesn't necessarily tell you whether the mere reference is error.
Your Honor, I don't think that it was that the purposeful use of those rights as substantive evidence of guilt is error. Actually, I take that back. The case law is very clear that what's improper is to use the exercise of rights as substantive evidence of guilt. If the exercise of rights is relevant for some other reason other than using that fact alone as substantive evidence of guilt, then it can be admissible. And this court has held that for other reasons other than substantive evidence of guilt, comments or references of an accused invocation of his rights were admissible or did not amount to plain error in a case like this where there was no, it didn't draw any objection from defense counsel.
Counsel, the standard for relevance is very low. Evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to determination more or less probable. Play the last two sets of questions, hypothetical. If the prosecution repeatedly introduces evidence of an individual's consultation with counsel, refusal to consent, and refusal to make statements, and all of those are introduced for sequential purposes, is the judge, and it's not argued, the inference isn't argued by trial counsel, but there are multiple references during trial. In that case, is the judge absolved from any responsibility, or does the judge still have to engage in a balancing test at that point in the totality of the circumstances of the whole trial to determine whether that evidence is prejudicial? And in particular, let's posit for the hypothetical that the relevance of any one of these matters is marginal at best, meets the bare standard for 401 relevance, but is hardly necessary for the prosecution's case.
Well, Your Honor, in the absence of a defense objection, the military judge only has a duty upon plain error. And in this case, specifically, there was no plain error. There was no plain or obvious error because of the context that all of these comments and all of these references came up in.
So getting back to my hypothetical, as opposed to this case, this is the government's position that if the government repeatedly introduces evidence of invocation of counsel rights, silence, non-consent to search, and that has some marginal but not material relevance to the issue of guilt or innocence, that the judge is under no obligation at that point to consider whether there's any effect in terms of the inference that the members might draw from the repeated introduction of that information.
Your Honor, that's a difficult question to answer because that's in a vacuum, and context is what's important in this analysis.
So if context is important, does the judge at least have to go through the thought process at that point? If the judge repeatedly hears these references to right, the judge has to go through the thought process of considering whether that balance has to take place.
I think it's fair to say that there has to at least be a thought process to, but that all goes towards whether or not it's plain error. Mm-hmm. And it would have to be plain or obvious, which is the situation we're in with the lack of a defense objection.
Or to turn it around the other way, then, the absence of a prosecution use of this information expressly does not necessarily mean that it's all permissible. That is, if the prosecution doesn't come out and lay the corn out there to be eaten and say, well, members, you can infer from all of these statements that the individual is guilty. If the prosecution doesn't say that, but merely allows that inference to rest, does that absence of an argument automatically say that there is never any error?
If I understand your question correctly, there could be, if it's plain error to allow the admission of the testimony without any kind of curative instruction or limiting instruction, that could, in a certain situation, be enough even without trial counsel capitalizing on that.
That's the question. I'm not asking you to concede anything about this case, just trying to assess, in a sense, the boundaries of what we're talking about here. That is, on the one hand, you have a case where evidence is introduced that has no relevance at all and counsel capitalizes on it. On the other, you could have evidence that is of marginal relevance and counsel says nothing. If the evidence has marginal evidence and counsel says nothing, does that automatically absolve the judge of any obligation to consider whether a curative instruction is necessary, or do you have to look at the facts and circumstances of the case?
Well, again, you have to look at the facts and circumstances of the case.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Assuming purely for the sake of argument that any error in this case is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's just for the sake of argument here for the next question.
Yes, sure.
Is there a principle of law that the government nonetheless believes this court should address and reach?
In the harmless error analysis?
In this case. Let's, as a hypothetical, if this court were to conclude that any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or if there was an error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, is this court, should this court, should be reaching an issue? Is there some legal dispute here that needs to be resolved nonetheless? Do you understand the question?
It's not the government's position that there's a legal dispute to be resolved, because the government's position is that the case law is clear about what is impermissible, and it's not a per se ban on any reference or comment to seeking counsel or refusing consent, but rather it's references that to those rights that are used as substantive evidence of guilt. So the government's not arguing for this court to hold any new legal conclusion or proposition of law.
That's what I'm testing. I'm not trying to, I'm just trying to strip away to see what the essential legal dispute is by turning it that way. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. With this court's permission, I would like to focus now on the second part of the government's argument, which is if, for purposes of argument, if this court were to find error, any such error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This court has repeatedly relied on the lack of defense objection, the strength of the government's case, and the implausibility of the defense theory to find harmless error. Despite appellant's contention in this case, the record demonstrates overwhelming evidence of his guilt. Six different witnesses testified about appellant's varied drug use. Specifically, four witnesses testified relating to his cocaine use, six witnesses relating to his ecstasy use, and four witnesses relating to his LSD use.
Were each of them immunized?
I believe all of them were immunized, Your Honor. Yes. Either all of them or the vast majority of them had already faced a court-martial of their own and were testifying, pursuing the establishment. The defense theory was weak. The defense was arguing that all six of these witnesses fabricated appellant's drug use in order to obtain those PTAs in their cases. However, all six of these witnesses' testimony corroborated each other's accounts of appellant's drug use, and the witnesses testified about the same drug uses that they themselves pled guilty at their own court-martial. Notably, when considering whether appellant was prejudiced in relation to these drug charges, the court should consider the fact that appellant's defense counsel in his closing argument conceded to the court members that appellant did in fact shave all of his body hair in order to prevent OSI from obtaining a hair sample. That was a concession made on the part of the trial defense counsel. And that consciousness of guilt evidence was overwhelming in this case. Turning to the DUI charge, the government's case was equally as strong with respect to that charge. Appellant was involved in a single car accident when the emergency responders arrived. He was the only individual present. In answering questions, appellant stated that he was going about 20 to 35 miles per hour, that he was wearing a seatbelt. That definitely infers that appellant was in fact the driver. The car was registered to him. And appellant made an admission that he had been drinking, and his blood alcohol results came back with a 0.25 blood alcohol content. So appellant's contention that was a hotly contested charge just simply does not coincide with the evidence that was presented at trial. And importantly, for all of these charges, no aspect of the government's case hinged on appellant's exercise of his right to an attorney or refusal to consent. The strong evidence in this case were the number of witnesses who observed appellant's drug use, the consciousness of guilt evidence that appellant shaved all of his body hair to avoid detection of his illegal drug use, and then with respect to the DUI charge, his admission that he had been drinking, as well as his 0.25 blood alcohol content. And all of that evidence was admissible regardless, even if none of these other comments that appellant complains of now didn't come into evidence. They were all independently admissible. When assessing prejudice, this court has often observed that the lack of defense objection to improper comments is some measure of the minimal impact of those improper comments. It's important to note that the Child Defense Counsel in appellant's case were not potted plants. They raised 14 different motions during trial and actively objected to other matters throughout the entire trial. In fact, they objected three times during Officer Frazier's testimony, twice during Special Agent Bourne's testimony. Prior to trial counsel's closing argument, the defense counsel made a motion in limine to preclude a certain line of argument. They objected once during trial counsel's closing argument. These were vigilant defense counsel. If nothing registered as improper in the minds of these vigilant...
But this is an... Is this an IAC claim?
No, there's no IAC.
So, I mean, in theory, counsel could have good tactical reasons not to highlight the exercise of constitutional rights. Is that fair to say?
They certainly...
I'm not sure why that argument necessarily breaks one way or the other in this case.
But in this case, what appellant is complaining of, what certainly these defense counsel could have requested at some point in time, because what appellant's complaining of did span throughout the trial, at some point in time could have requested a 39A session to address the admissibility of the evidence or any curative or limiting instructions with the military judge, certainly.
Without highlighting it to the court members,
yes, Your Honor. We also have in this case another powerful indication of the strength of the government's case, and that's that for the specifications that the court members found appellant guilty of for the drug use, they announced their findings by unanimous decision. Now, when you take that coupled with the fact that appellant was acquitted of half of the specifications that he was charged with, including some of the drug specifications, this court can be fully confident that these comments did not tend to brand appellant as someone who is just in general a criminal or is in general guilty. If appellant had been convicted of every single specification, there might be more reason to pause there. But given this situation, for those specifications that he was found guilty of, it was by a unanimous decision, and then he was acquitted of other specifications, this court can be...
Did the acquittal go to any of the specifications for which the evidence at issue is now under consideration?
He was acquitted of marijuana use, Your Honor, which could have been detected through a hair analysis. He was also acquitted of possession of ecstasy and possession of marijuana.
But was the possession in any way related to the argument that was made that's at issue here? That possession offense?
I'm sorry, are you referring to?
Right, to the argument that defense counsel is complaining about. Did the trial counsel make that argument with respect to either the possession or with respect to the marijuana offense of which he was acquitted?
You're asking, did the appellant complain of any comments that went towards an argument on the marijuana? The comments of the appellant complains of the requesting to see an attorney or being on his way to see a civilian attorney. Based on appellant's argument, that would go towards any charge or any specification that he was charged with. Just in response to a couple of things in appellate defense counsel's argument, the jack of all crimes theme that the prosecution used at this trial, that is just a saying that basically is commenting on the variety of charges and specifications that the appellant was charged with. His crimes that he was charged with just ran the gamut. They went from larceny to disorderly conduct to drug use to DUI. That's what the jack of all crimes theme was. It was in no way tied in with any references to his invoking or exercising his constitutional rights. Appellate defense counsel also argued that consent was a vital issue to the members because they acquitted him of the possession of marijuana. That was something evidence did come forward that that appellant did consent to that search of his residence where the marijuana was found. This was not a baggie of marijuana that was found. It was an extremely small stem of marijuana that was found in the closet in between where the door shuts and where the carpet begins. That is likely, and this was an apartment that he had roommates, that he shared this apartment with other people. That is likely the reason that he was acquitted of the possession of marijuana specification, not because the members attached such significance to the fact that he consented to that search versus not consenting to a hair analysis. I'd also like to address specifically some of the comments that appellant complains of, one being the testimony that when OSI tried to bring appellant in to take the hair sample pursuant to the search authorization, that the appellant at that time was not available because he was on his way to see his civilian attorney in Hattiesburg. That comment did not come about in the context of official questioning or in response to a rights advisement. And it's not per se improper to ever comment that somebody has an appointment or a meeting with their attorney. And in the context that that came up in, that he was on his way to Hattiesburg to see a civilian attorney, it's ambiguous. Was he on his way to see his tax attorney? Was he on his way to see his divorce attorney? Or was he on his way to see a civilian attorney he retained for his downtown DUI charge?
Does that mean that if the word criminal were in front of that, the government would say that that would have been error?
No, Your Honor, because certainly he could have been, the members were aware of the fact that he was charged with a DUI offense that happened downtown a month prior to the time frame of his charged drug uses. So they could have reasonably inferred that he was seeing a civilian attorney downtown with respect to the DUI charge, which has nothing to do with the hair sample or the hair analysis.
Is the test what the members could have inferred out of many different implications, or what they might have inferred? That is, you're suggesting that they could have inferred a benign explanation for this. Is that our test, or is the test whether the members could have inferred an improper implication from it? I'm not asking what the answer is on what they should, what they did or did not infer, but in terms of the way we look at it, why shouldn't we look at this in terms of, was there a reasonable possibility that the members inferred an improper purpose?
Well, because we're in a plain error analysis, the test is whether it's plain and obvious that the members would have used this as substantive evidence of guilt. And that's not the case here. Finally, turning to the evidence that came through, or the testimony from Officer Ford, that appellant initially consented to having his blood drawn for a blood alcohol test, and then upon arriving at the hospital, he refused to sign the consent form. It's important to note that this was in the state of Mississippi, that Mississippi has an implied consent law, and the Supreme Court has upheld a similar implied consent law in for the state of South Dakota, in South Dakota versus Neville. And the Supreme Court has commented that there is no constitutional right to refuse consent to a blood alcohol test under such an implied consent law. So that testimony regarding his refusal to sign the consent form in an implied consent state, that is admissible pursuant to the Mississippi implied consent statute.
Under what theory does Mississippi law govern what is or is not admissible in a court-martial? I understand the theory by which Mississippi law would govern our consideration and the trial court's consideration as to whether or not there was a proper search under Mississippi law. But how can Mississippi, as a state of the union, govern what is or is not admissible in a court-martial that's conducted under federal law?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not that the state law is governing what's admissible in the court-martial, but pursuant, because he was operating a vehicle in the state of Mississippi, operating a vehicle, motor vehicle in that jurisdiction, you're deemed to have consented to a blood alcohol test.
So on the issue of whether he consented or not, or had to consent or not, for purposes of admissibility, that state law would be relevant. How does it come in as substantive evidence in the case?
Well, Your Honor, it's only impermissible in a court-martial if it's using a substance of evidence of guilt and an exercise of a constitutional right. And the Supreme Court has held that under implied consent statutes, there is no constitutional right to refuse consent. So that's how it comes into play with the evidence of this court-martial.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I'm not sure if you've addressed the closing arguments. Is it the government's position that when the government counsel argued that the OSI says we'd like to take your hair, he says, no, thank you, I want to talk to my attorney first? That's not error?
Your Honor, the government does concede error with that particular comment, the no thank you, I want to speak to my attorney first, because that was a mischaracterization of the testimony of Special Agent Bourne. That actually was not what Special Agent Bourne testified to, and that wasn't any of the, there was no evidence that when asked to consent, he said, no, I want to speak to my attorney first.
But if it wasn't a mischaracterization, would that have been proper argument for the government counsel in closing?
Absent some other contextual reason that would make it relevant, no, it would not be proper argument, Your Honor. Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude. In sum, the comments that appellant complains of did not treat his exercise of his rights as substantive evidence of guilt. They were admissible as relevant background and chronology evidence. Appellant has failed to show plain error, and in any event, even if this court were to assume error, any such error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the strength of the government's case and the minimal impact of any of these comments. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? I'd like to ask you to address at the outset, I know you'll want to have some rebuttal, the point regarding Mississippi law, and that is whether the existence of the implied consent law in Mississippi, as the government has suggested, means that with respect to that particular issue in the case, there's no constitutional error, because there'd be no constitutional right to refuse the consent.
Your Honor, our position is that Mississippi law in this case should not apply. Mississippi law of implied consent is based on the Fifth Amendment. Essentially, implied consent, or the use of that in an implied consent context, is that the appellant or the accused in that case refuses a blood draw, and his refusal is used as substantive evidence against him, and that's not what happened in this case. In this case, he refused the blood draw. Probable cause was held by a magistrate, and a search was issued by his by the police officer. The sticking point in that is, as expressed in, I believe, South Dakota v. Neville, was that in an implied consent context, the accused is given a choice whether to consent or whether to have a blood draw. In this case, he was not given a choice either to consent or to give a blood draw. It was involuntarily taken from him. As such, Mississippi law should not apply. And to adopt a state law as substantively a rule of evidence should not be the case. It impugns upon the right of the president to promulgate rules for court-martial and military rules of evidence.
But the question is, does it amount to plain error? That's the government's point here. Not that we should adopt that as the law of admissibility in courts-martial, but was there plain error in light of the authority to take without consent?
Yes, Your Honor, there was plain error in this case. It is established that the appellant's right to fail to consent should not be used as substantive evidence against him. There is no indication in military law that that implied consent has been adopted in this manner. Therefore, Mississippi law should not be used as essentially a military rule of evidence. We would assert that this goes against the president's role under Article 36.
What is the essential difference or question of law between you and the government in this case?
Sorry?
What is the essential question of law that you and the government disagree on in this case?
The essential point of law is the government uses the constitutional rights or adopts a test of mere relevance for its inclusion in a court-martial. And the use of constitutional rights by the prosecution is the exception and not the rule. To say that the use of rights can be established in any context is relegating it again to a test of relevance. And the test for relevance of inclusion in the court-martial is quite low under MRE 401.
Let me try it a different way, restate the question. What, in one sentence, what would you hope the holding of this court would be, other than you win?
That use of constitutional rights in merely to establish simple, relevant evidence is unconstitutional.
Okay.
Even in Arguendo, if this evidence was admissible...
That's the different position you took in your brief, where you were arguing for a totality of the circumstances review of the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
So have you changed your position since you wrote the brief?
I believe we have, Your Honor.
And what's the authority that you're relying on now that a totality of the circumstances review of the record would be the inappropriate test?
Well, Your Honor, our reliance would be on MRE 402, which basically states that relevant evidence is admissible except as provided by the Constitution. This seems to take this out of a mere relevance context.
But we're in a plain error context here. We're not in a context where the defense objected at trial and asked for 402 balancing.
Yes, Your Honor. However, as established in case law, the use of constitutional evidence is again the exception and not the rule. There is only one hard and fast context in which constitutional rights, the prosecution is allowed to use appellant's invocation of constitutional right, and that's essentially when the defense opens the door, and that's not what occurred in this case.
Use or elude?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Use or elude?
I would say no use.
Okay. You're maintaining they used it here for the specific purpose.
Yes, Your Honor. No. Irrespective of that, the military judge should have recognized the error based on 401F3 and the case laws established in Fletcher, Clifton, and Turner. These were plain errors that the military judge should have responded to in a timely fashion and given a curative instruction. The military judge gave no curative instruction after, or no instructions in regards to the use of this evidence after trial counsel's argument, or even after he elicited information from himself during the trial, or after the witnesses themselves volunteered this information. Case law suggests that if a timely curative instruction was given in that fashion, that the error would have been vitiated. But the military judge made no attempt to cure this error. And our focus would be on cases of Clifton and Carter. Even when the military judge did attempt to give curative instructions, they did it too late and they were not focused, and therefore in both cases required reversal. To sum up, the military judge should have taken several steps to ensure the fairness of the trial, and the potential danger was apparent throughout the entire trial, especially given in the context of trial counsel's theme. The essence of criminality, of the appellant's criminality, and the danger of misinterpretation was readily apparent, especially given the fact that the most damning evidence in this case was the appellant's invocation of his right to an attorney and his failure to consent to a search of his body hair should have keyed the judge in, and therefore the failure for him to give the curative instructions is plain error. Is there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess until tomorrow afternoon when we convene at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law for a project outreach hearing.